Picture announcing to your immigrant parents that you're moving back to the country they fled, the one they escaped with nothing but relief and a framed portrait of Lenin they kept in the fridge so he could watch American Plenty and weep. That's exactly what happened in 2011 when the call came to return to Moscow as editor-in-chief of Russian GQ. The timing seemed perfect. Moscow was alive with middle-class protests against Putin, organized by media professionals who could have been friends. Russia offered what felt like a space-time shortcut to success, a place desperately trying to become New York, making it a playground for actual New Yorkers. But there was something else, something harder to admit. The chance to finally resolve an identity that had never quite settled, to understand what being Russian actually meant when you'd spent your whole life running from it. Being a Soviet Jew meant occupying a peculiar nowhere, marked by your surname, your features, and the eternal stigma of rootless cosmopolitanism that guaranteed you'd never be fully Russian. Childhood unfolded in a dreary communal apartment on Karl Marx Street in Riga, Latvia, sharing space with alcoholics and madmen. While Soviet schools force-fed Russian literature wrapped in ideology, real connection came through 1980s Leningrad rock, new wave sounds, with ambitious lyrics that spoke to the alienation of never quite belonging. When Latvia declared independence in 1990, being Russian suddenly meant being unwanted. Arriving in Cleveland as a refugee in 1992 at 16, the alienation simply shifted contexts, now flipping burgers at McDonald's while being called commie at school, formal English making you an outsider among both Americans and fellow immigrants. The obsessive need to prove Russian rock was just as good as American music eventually faded. By 1998, living in Brooklyn and interning at the Village Voice, the Russian past seemed successfully relegated to trivia, a footnote to a new American identity built on corduroy and indie credibility. In August 1998, billboards across Moscow announced Russian Vogue's arrival with "In Russia, at long last." For a country desperate to become normal, a fashion magazine carried outsized significance. But 1998 Russia was profoundly abnormal. Oligarchs had risen from crooked privatization, crime syndicates thrived, and legitimate industry had collapsed. Condé Nast's Moscow operation was headed by Bernd Runge, an East German who spoke Russian, later revealed as a former Stasi agent. Just as Vogue's premier issue went to press, Russia defaulted on its debt on August 17, 1998. The ruble crashed to one-third its value, wiping out fortunes. Yet paradoxically, the crisis made Vogue an even more aspirational beacon. By 2000, it spawned GQ Russia, which under editor Nikolai Uskov became a professional, wealth-obsessed publication that offered an unexpected path back into Russian media. In December 2011, young revolutionaries gathered in a Moscow bistro planning the next day's protest. These 20-somethings, editors of Afisha and Bolshoi Gorod, were fighting apathy, not oppression. Putin's power vertical had disabled all governance levers except the president's, creating what officials called sovereign democracy and Russians mockingly termed souvenir democracy. The regime allowed just enough dissent to satisfy Western journalists without threatening power. The internet remained uncensored, dismissed as an elite toy. These stability's children had channeled civic energy into small deeds, cleaning parks rather than challenging government. 2 weeks earlier, they'd organized 60,000 people at Bolotnaya Square. Now, Facebook RSVPs for tomorrow's protest climbed past 51,000. The same people who once recommended restaurants were organizing a revolution. It felt electric, historic, the moment Russia's middle class would finally demand real democracy. What no one grasped yet was how thoroughly the regime had prepared for this moment. Landing in Moscow with one suitcase, the first HR lesson was stark. You cannot fire anyone, ever. Saying you're fired triggers a 12-month salary payout, a Soviet-era protection creating absurd dynamics where employees might deliberately underperform, hoping to provoke termination. The editorial vision was clear. institute real features, redirect money from celebrity columnists to young journalists pursuing actual stories, build the website. But these editors didn't actually edit. They wrote, managed columnists, organized, yet improving others' texts left most drawing a blank. Half the magazine's one-page sections existed solely to serve adjacent advertisements, valuable special positions for their predictability. The team included a Casanova film critic with a lazy eye, a bespectacled intellectual obsessed with regional hip-hop and meme curation, the anonymous duo behind @KremlinRussia satirizing the Kremlin. Personal principles began weakening. After refusing gifts went unrecognized, while opposition editors freely took freebies, the descent began. Soon it was Louboutin shoes, test driving a free Jaguar, paying bribes to traffic cops. The corruption wasn't dramatic. It was ambient, inevitable, exhausting. The March 2012 presidential election appeared routine, Putin's third term assured. The question, would the Kremlin accommodate protesters or retaliate? Initial signals seemed conciliatory, simplified party registration, restored gubernatorial elections. Vladislav Surkov, Putinism's architect, praised protesters as society's most productive part, but his mention of laws to deal with provocateurs revealed the truth. Putin won with 63.6%. His victory speech dismissed opposition as provocations aimed at destroying Russia's statehood. At 9:40 p.m., after permits expired, Oman riot police dragged vocal critics to jail. Then came Pussy Riot, five women in bright tights entering Christ the Savior Cathedral on February 21, 2012. Their punk prayer lasted 40 seconds. Three members faced charges of hooliganism motivated by religious hatred, 7 years possible. The trial transformed them into dissidents. Three young women in the same glass cage used for Khodorkovsky, delivering defiant speeches as historic as those of Solzhenitsyn and Brodsky. On August 17th, the verdict, 2 years for 40 seconds, 18 days per second. Russia retaliated against the Magnitsky Act by banning American adoptions. Putin's third term grew increasingly absurd. The president photographed communing with animals, while the Duma filled with demagogues demanding Orthodox Christianity in the Constitution. Then Ukraine erupted. In 2013, President Yanukovych abandoned an EU agreement after meeting Putin, accepting a Russian loan instead. Protesters established a tent city in Kiev's Maidan. By February 2014, dozens were dead and Yanukovych had fled. The day after Sochi Olympics closed, green men, Russian soldiers without insignia, seized Crimea. The annexation took 3 weeks, complete with a sham referendum held under Russian guns. Moscow simultaneously fueled separatist movements across eastern Ukraine. The Kremlin's denials represented a new power lie, whose obviousness was the point. Russians knew Putin was lying and approved anyway. As Russian journalism collapsed, talented writers fled to screenwriting. On March 5, 2015, opposition leader Boris Nemtsov was gunned down near Red Square while documenting Russia's Ukraine involvement. The murder remains unsolved. Russians now rank Crimea's annexation as their proudest moment after World War II, surpassing space exploration and literary achievements. Being compromised by Russia means being compromised by greed and insecurity, coding self-interest in righteous bladder. But whoever resists this illusion will eventually win. The question isn't whether Russia will change, but whether we'll recognize the same patterns spreading everywhere else.